Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. There's a backstory to this American spring, this season of COVID panic and death, and the big black and white protest against criminal injustice. There are many backstories, of course, but in the mix of them, an outline appears of an underlying condition in our country. Our guests this hour pinpointed evidence of an untold story 5 years ago in the uptick of self-inflicted death. What they located was a surge of suicide in the 20-teens. It's been centered among dropouts from the white working class, mostly men, self-medicating by drugs and alcohol to the point of self-destruction. These are people adrift at midlife, beyond the consolations of work, family, church, or neighborhood. And in the year 2017 alone, there were 158,000 of them who opted out. More Americans than have died in the COVID epidemic so far. Ann Case and Angus Deaton are senior economists at Princeton. Angus won a Nobel Prize in 2015. Deaths of Despair is the morbidly enthralling book that they researched and wrote together. It is not economics exactly, more like a detective novel. It's a search without a simple solution, from a step back to set numbers into a national narrative. The dark beauty of this book is its inclusiveness, I think. I mean, you're economists, but you're addressing the whole humanity of the country, mind, body, spirit, and the whole thing is limping.
I think that's a pretty fair description. We are economists, but economists are social scientists. We are interested in more than just markets and money. There's a famous quote by Arthur Cecil Pigou, who said that the fundamental reason for studying economics was to do something about the mean streets and withered minds, which I think is a wonderful phrase. And it's very different from a conception of economics that's to do with the allocation of scarce resources by means of the price system, if you know what I mean. And I think we're in the former camp there.
And?
Also, with the topic that we took on, it was really important to reach out to sociologists and demographers and medical doctors, because when one starts to study mortality, and especially premature mortality, why are people killing themselves in these ways? We looked at the economic forces, but we really couldn't try to get inside what people might be thinking without looking at the social fabric and what was happening to it over this period of time.
And also, you know, economists have thought a bit about suicide, not very successfully. And, you know, economists tend to say everything's a cost-benefit analysis. So it makes you happier to kill yourself than to go on living, to put it crudely. And that may give you some insight into what's happening to someone who's elderly and very, very sick. But it doesn't seem to take us very far otherwise. And we find the more we thought about that, the more we led to Durkheim and to Durkheim's insights, more than 100 years old, but still extremely useful.
Amazing how Durkheim survives. I take it to be the bottom line from Durkheim that suicides happen in the context of a society. They're not just individual calculations of risk or benefit or anything else. You wrote Deaths of Despair before the virus. We read it after, and we cannot help taking it as a sort of backstory of the general crisis of this American spring, people are calling it, the COVID epidemic, plus the economic knockdown, plus the George Floyd case that broke the dam of black protest that feeds on COVID injustice as well. It's a huge complex by now. But you've given us x-rays, MRIs almost, of the American patient. And you see all kinds of different symptoms and a great deal more trouble coming. Where do you want to begin in your search for what drove these deaths at midlife?
We started by looking at the relationship between death from drugs, alcohol, suicide, and the economy at present? Like, is it the case that when people's incomes fall, they are more susceptible? Is it the case when the unemployment rate is higher that people are more susceptible? And what we found was that at a national level, there was no close articulation between what was happening to people's incomes or employment and what was happening to these trends, which were going up smoothly before the Great Recession, through the Great Recession, and after the Great Recession. So we thought, our first foray into this, which was to think of it as something with like current economic determinants, didn't get us very far. So we had to broaden out and think about the fact that this is happening only to people without a four-year college degree. People with a college degree look a lot like Europeans. Their mortality was falling. They weren't falling to drugs and alcohol and suicide. It seemed to be something that was really hitting people with less than a BA.
And that was a piece of really good fortune, which turned out to be the clue that we could pull on. And much of the rest of the book came around that, which is this distinction between whether or not you have a four-year college degree. And, you know, that started as an accident, because if you look at American death certificates, it's written on them, your highest level of education. It doesn't tell you what your income was or what job you had or anything like that. And then as we got further into the book, looking at marriage patterns, looking at pain, looking at church going, looking at participation in the labor force, everything that unrolls chapter by chapter in the book.
Note the surprise in this, that the deaths of despair are among white people. It's not the black pattern.
You know, this parallel was first suggested to us by President Obama in the White House, who said, your story you're telling is what happened to the blacks 40 years ago, and you should work on that parallel. And in some sense, it's right. I mean, that in the 60s and 70s, when the first wave of globalization came and took away jobs from inner city blacks, many of whom had come from the countryside, they were not particularly well educated. One story you can think of is that American capitalism is sort of shedding workers according to their skill levels, starting with least skilled and working up. And now what's happening is happening to the white, less educated people. And of course, there's not a perfect parallel on these things. You know, one of the big things that even Durkheim knew was that black people don't kill themselves at much lower rates than whites. So that's always been true. But there was the drug epidemic, the crack epidemic, disintegration of families. So much of the story we're telling for whites had already happened to blacks. And so it's not they're exempt. It's just that this bad stuff came for them first.
It's like the wheel has come back around, and this time it's come for the white working class. We grappled with that a lot, because when we first started this work, the only group whose mortality rates were rising were whites. So for blacks and Hispanics, mortality rates fell until about 2014. And then they flatlined after fentanyl, which is a heavy duty opioid that hit the streets in 2013. Suddenly black mortality, which had been falling nicely, started to rise as well. But until fentanyl came along, the mortality from drugs and alcohol for blacks was falling terrifically while it was rising for whites. So the reason we really first focused this work on whites was because everyone else looked like they were moving in the right direction. And even though black mortality is still higher than whites, there was real convergence going on. So we thought, well, what the heck is happening to this group of whites and why? What's underneath that? So we found that without a good job, people stopped thinking that they could get married. So back in 1980, with or without a bachelor's degree, the fraction of people married whites at any age was about the same. But decade to decade to decade, marriage rates fell for people without a BA. And our friends in sociology who work on fragile families tell us that when they do interviews, that's what they hear, that people don't want to get married until one of them has a job with prospects. So very fragile home lives.
The line in the old days used to be marriageable men. These poor guys are not, obviously.
Yeah, and as the labor market, you know, turns against them, they become less and less marriageable. And, you know, the stories the sociologists tell are of, you know, a woman shacks up with some guy, but, you know, she's not going to get married because he doesn't have the sort of prospect she's looking for. And maybe she'll have a kid or even two kids with them. And then she finds someone who looks like he has better prospects and you move on. And so these guys who get to be their mid-50s, which is the first group we ever looked at, find that they may have kids that they don't even know because they're living with other people. You know, it's things like that. And this structure of a working class life, which has sort of grown in America since the late 19th century, sort of unraveling, which are much more plausible stories of people doing away with themselves, or indeed being in the sort of despair that pharmaceutical drugs or drug sellers, legal or illegal, can exploit.
Let me say, the news of your research started seeping out, in my memory, 3 or 4, maybe 5 years ago, along the time of the absolute decline of American life expectancy overall. And then you discovered the suicide piece, Deaths of Despair. By now, it's the strangest sort of epidemic, but 158,000 deaths in 2017 is more than the deaths from the coronavirus this year. We're talking about a real epidemic, one in which, unbelievably, people were doing it to themselves. Go on down that road of reasons why.
You talked at the beginning about this being a detective story, and it's a lot like that in that you were trying to probe the characteristics of these deaths and then see what we know about them that's different. And, you know, the fact that it only happens to people who don't have a 4-year college degree. So whatever story you come up with has to be centered around that. It's not happening in other countries. In fact, it's happening small scale in Britain, especially in Scotland, where I grew up. But by and large, other countries are not suffering from this, though it's possible they will in due course.
Coming up, more Deaton and Case on the education piece of this puzzle and the hard split between workers who got a college degree and those who didn't. In the college crowd, you get a ticket into the meritocracy. Outside it, you don't. And the cut is made early, from kindergarten, from pre-kindergarten, as Anne Case put it to us. The entire focus in school is on the subset of those kids who are college-bound. Often, it's a majority of the graduating high school class that doesn't go to 4 years of college. But those kids leave high school without the skill set for the work world and what's called a good life. This is Open Source. As they tracked Deaths of Despair, an epidemic of midlife suicides in America over the last decade, the Princeton economists Angus Deaton and Anne Case found that almost nothing is working these days for less educated people, men in particular. Not the job market, not American-style capitalism, and not the school system that most kids are exposed to.
We built this sort of plutocratic meritocracy based around having a 4-year college degree. And, you know, no one wants to go back to the days when, you know, the Duke of X or the Earl of Y or Sir someone had inherited a title and with it all this privilege. But at least they had the thing that the people who were not privileged could not blame themselves, nor did the people who were privileged. They understood that they just inherited it. It wasn't their own doing. So now you have these people with BA who, you know, these educated elite who are doing great, and they think it's all their own effort. They minimize the role of luck. They think they deserve it, and they think people don't have it, don't deserve it. And of course, some of the people who didn't make it, half of them think the world is rigged against them, which is true. And the others think, well, you know, maybe I am at fault to some extent. And that, I think, is very hard for them. So we've got this very sharp division that really didn't used to be there.
What's wrong with the meritocracy? I think of myself as a meritocrat. My father didn't finish high school. I got a superb college education on scholarship. And here we are. Chris Hayes of MSNBC has written interestingly about this. There's a kind of guilt among the ones who make it and a certain resentment of ones that don't. What's to be changed?
In The Twilight of the Elites, I found that a very powerful read.
So did I.
But I really do think that meritocracies could blow themselves out after a generation because people have children. They want to protect their children's places. And the easiest way to do that is to pull up the ladders behind themselves and call us the gifted ones, and anyone who can't afford the extra school lessons or, you know, the special things that come with a good private school education, they're on their own.
You know, it's interesting, too, the guy who invented the term meritocracy, it only goes back to 1958. A guy called Michael Young, who finished up actually being a British lord. He was ennobled in his old age when he was poor, and he accepted the ennoblement so that he could use the per diems to go to the Houses of Parliament and participate in the debates. But he was a very, very interesting guy. He had a very hard time publishing this book about meritocracy. But the book is a dystopian fantasy of what will happen around 2020 or maybe a little later once you have this meritocracy in place. And it's a disaster. The world is divided into two groups, one of whom he presciently calls the populists, and the other one, and that's us looking at ourselves in the mirror, the educated elite, he refers to as the hypocrisy. And it's just a disaster. There's a civil war between these, and it reads like Brexit or it reads like the Trump election. And Chris Hayes was onto a lot of that.
Other clues out there. Many of these people killing themselves had lost their grip on families, on union membership, on even attachment to a corporation or a business, also to a church, even to a neighborhood and a town. Rate these as causative factors.
I think they're all causal factors. I mean, it made me think for a moment of someone, you know, once when I was a teenager, I went down a coal mine in Scotland, and it was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life, that these people were hacking at the coal face, and as they opened out the seam, there were these pit props that were holding up the roof, and they took them from behind them and moved them forward, right? It's sort of like, well, which pit prop caused the mine to fall in and kill all these people? Well, who knows which one it was? It's like chipping away at something, and nothing happens, nothing happens, nothing happens. And then you take away enough of the supports, and it all falls down upon your head. In fact, your list is just a great list. You might have been able to survive one of those things or two of those things, but with all of those happening at the same time, the way you live your life has just lost its meaning, lost its structure.
And that's the Durkheim social integration gone. I mean, in the U.S., unlike Europe, the institution of organized religion has always been incredibly important. So the fact that that is gone as well, that this place where I could have gone to find solace, gone.
Yeah, and we don't want to say they're gone. I mean, it's just these are trends that have gone on for a long time. And it is like, you know, the pit props are weakening, and then the mine is going to come down on your head after, you know, it's not one day. It's many days.
Going back to church, certainly going back to the old-fashioned family, father the breadwinner, mother the housewife, would be a contested and maybe very difficult undertaking. How could it be undertaken without reasserting the old classification of the population by gender?
We are certainly not in favor of that. You know, what you said about the meritocracy is exactly right, too, because there are many of these things are steps forward. You know, we don't want to oppress women. We don't want to oppress gays, and never mind race. That's not a world that anyone wants to return to. But what you do want is a world in which, you know, people have a really chance to make a good career for themselves, to have good jobs, and then to use the money and the meaningfulness that comes from those jobs to build the lives that they want. There are many things that make a good life, and different people have different ideas of what that is. But you have to provide the fuel and the space, if you like, the capabilities to do that. And the economy is just not doing that right now, or progressively not doing that for people without a four-year college degree. And that's sort of a tragedy.
Ann Case and Angus Deaton, in your book on deaths of despair, far and away the strongest condemnation you make is of the healthcare system. I'm quoting you, a leading example of an institution that under political protection redistributes income upward to hospitals, physicians, device makers, and pharmaceutical companies, not to say insurance companies, while delivering among the worst health outcomes of any rich country. That's a much stronger broadside than any of the candidates in 2020 for president have made. You got to spell that out. I live 5 blocks from the Massachusetts General Hospital where I was born, where I had my primary care. What is conspicuously a sort of cathedral of medicine, prices very high, service incredibly good, I would have to say, qualifications to get in unbelievably high. What went wrong?
Well, I like the way you use the word cathedral, right? Because that's a very, very apt thing. And it probably does your health about as good as a cathedral would.
That's funny.
And indeed, if you go to the Harvard, someone pointed this out the other day, if you go to the Harvard Medical School, which is not so far away either, it's all marble and pillars and glass. And, you know, it's a real temple.
It always was, to be fair.
Always was. But you go to the Harvard School of Public Health, right? And it's in a shack somewhere, not far from Harvard Yard. We've discovered in the current epidemic, the COVID epidemic, that public health is really sort of important and much neglected. And the healthcare system is not really helping us. Well, it's not that it doesn't help us.
Yeah,
and now is not a good time to beat up on doctors and nurses and hospitals, right?
But do what you must.
Obviously, these institutions are full of really good people. So what's the but? We have this healthcare system that costs twice as much as any other healthcare system anywhere in the world. Swiss are the next. And the Swiss share of GDP compared to the American share of healthcare and GDP is about 6% lower. They have better outcomes than we do on all measurable things. So if we lost 6% of GDP, you know, which is not seeming to do us any real good, that is $1 trillion a year. I mean, you're really talking about real money here. People say, well, look, health is not really a matter, you can't blame the hospital system for people poisoning themselves and so on. Well, that's exactly right. On the other hand, there are measures of preventable deaths, deaths that could be dealt with by appropriate medical care. And we do really badly on that too. So we're not delivering anything. And we try in the book to talk about what those costs have been, not in terms of billions of dollars, but in terms of people's lives being destroyed.
Well, in terms of life being destroyed, economies being destroyed, the incredibly high cost of health insurance or health care, well over $10,000 per year per American, makes it almost impossible for small businesses to hire people. You can't take on that thing, and it has everything to do with job opportunities disappearing in this country for the marginal working class.
The family policy in 2019 was $21,000 a year on average, and the employer share is 70% of that. So when I've got a low-skilled worker who's only worth to me about $30,000, you know, I can't afford to keep that person on and pay them even minimum wage.
So, you know, when I was a kid growing up in Scotland in a very lower middle class part of Edinburgh, the ideal was to get a job with a big firm. And then someone gets a job in their 20s or something with a big firm. You say, well, oh, what are you doing for them? And they say, well, I'm working in the mailroom. And you say, well, are you happy about that? I say, yeah, this is a great company to work for. And also, a mailroom is a starting job. I can work my way up. Maybe I'll get a job behind a desk. Maybe I'll finish up being the CEO. All of those things. You were part of this enterprise. And the cost of healthcare has sort of made that impossible. And companies don't have their own janitors anymore. They have the what Anne calls the Albright cleaning company. And then there's the Ramjam transport company that provides your drivers. They don't offer these people much in the way of benefits. There's no prospects whatsoever. What prospects can you get in a janitorial supply company?
Your model is Scotland. Mine, and not everybody likes this idea, but is Cuba. Cuba is the medical capital of the Caribbean. They have superb medical care and results very, very close to ours and better in a number of instances. They doctor to Africa, they doctor to the world, and they do it at less than 10% of our price. Right about $1,000 per person. You're talking 10 or 25 for a family. Why in the world can't we learn something from that without having to begin with denouncing the Castro regime forever and ever?
It's an industry that has done an incredibly good job at protecting itself.
Our own, you mean?
our own, that doctors sit on the boards that decide how many seats there will be in medical schools and how many residencies there will be. They keep those numbers down. When the numbers are down, the wages are high, right? They make it very hard for foreign doctors to get residencies so that they can practice in the U.S. That's the physician part. With pharmaceuticals, they for a long time now have been sitting in the catbird seat because the federal government will not negotiate with them over drug prices. The federal government receives the drug prices and pays them what they say is required.
It used to be that the pharma industry was against what became Medicare Part D, which is the prescription drug benefit for seniors. And they were against it because they thought if that was instituted, the government would insist on price control, which would be a perfectly reasonable thing for the government to insist on. And it was only as they got bigger and bigger and as they got more and more lobbyists and they had more and more muscle that they switched side when they realized they had enough muscle to get the benefit without any price controls. And, you know, that's the story of that. And, you know, there are five industry lobbyists for every member of Congress, and they're very good at their jobs.
So it would be harder if, for example, we did have the best health in the world and we had the longest life expectancy in the world. And you would say, well, it's expensive, but look what we get for it. But our life expectancy is the lowest among any of the rich countries, right? Our along many metrics, our health is worse than in many most other rich countries. So it's not that kind of a trade-off that we should be willing to pay for to make some very wealthy people much richer. And it's regular people, it's ordinary people, it's coming out of their pockets.
Maybe the gravest sin in healthcare, in the industry, in the hospitals, is finding that pain is indeed a profit center. When did that happen? Did it have to happen? Is it being reversed by the Sackler scandals?
You know, doctors are now much more reluctant to prescribe these things, opioids, than was the case. It clearly was a social change that was pushed by the industry.
But it's also the case that for many years, Vicodin was one of the most prescribed drugs in America, which I believe I'd have to go back and look, but I think it has an MME, a morphine milligram equivalent of one, whereas OxyContin is 1.5. So OxyContin is more powerful, but Vicodin is no shirker. But we did not have an opioid crisis just brought on by Vicodin. Something else happened and people wanted something to use to numb themselves out. So while we think that there are real villains out there, like the Purdue Pharmaceuticals sending 800 marketers around the country targeting areas where they thought the pain levels of working class people would be higher, like there are villains in the story, but there's also something else that happened that tripped that switch and started this epidemic.
They saw the smoldering despair and thought, oh, we have some propellant to put on that smoldering despair and turn it into a real fire. But I mean, our story really is that despair is prior to the opioid crisis. And the opioid crisis was made enormously worse by allowing pharma companies to do that.
Come back to the big subject of capitalism, American capitalism. The full title of your book is Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. Is this to say it's not over yet? American capitalism might somehow be rescued. You also note, though, that American capitalism, as it works, begins to look more like a racket for redistributing upward than an engine of general prosperity. What about capitalism?
I think there's enormous power in capitalism, in markets, as Adam Smith said, sort of in the power of greed to make people better off. But, you know, it needs to be regulated. And there are bits of capitalism, there are parts of the economy, and the healthcare is perhaps the leading example, though banking would be close second, you know, where unless it's turned to benefit people, it will not benefit people. You'll have, you know, a capitalism that benefits itself and hurts people instead of a capitalism that benefits people.
Even Adam Smith realized that we needed to hold the reins on capitalism, that by itself it would run amok. By itself it would not benefit people. So people who believe in markets, Adam Smith is their big hero, but even Adam Smith would have said, be careful with this. You need to make sure that the monopolists don't get a hold of things. If you want to keep it on the rails, you're going to have to watch what's happening very closely.
But this, I must say, is where I began to wonder about your book and your remedies. We already have an incredibly entrenched 1% capitalist system, and I don't see where you're ready to challenge it. You say, for the two of you, we do not see inequality as the fundamental problem. It's certainly one of the giant symptoms. You don't embrace the Green New Deal or other sort of fundamental ways to restructure American capitalism. And you also note that a historian's view that these things do not correct themselves. When they get deeply embedded, they wait only for a revolution. What are you going to do about the incredible excesses and deprivations in this economic system we have?
Well, I think deprivations are the right thing to think about and not inequality per se. We want to draw attention to something else, which is how many of these people have gotten super rich by corrupting the government. And, you know, when we talk to congressmen, they talk about campaign finance reform, for instance, which seems like a big deal here. I think even just casting a bright light on it, on how much, for instance, the healthcare system, but not just the healthcare system, are getting rich by corrupting the government.
Coming up, the wealth and power concentration questions that presidential candidates love to duck. This is Open Source. Can you still call it capitalism when risk-free monopolies rule so many markets? And would you expect to hear presidential candidates talking about, say, surveillance capitalism, which people see by now in those giant tech companies fattening on the information we offer up for nothing? Angus Deaton and Anne Case are not at all sure about how such a predatory system gets fixed. This is where politics comes in. In the 2020 campaign, which was cut short in the primaries by COVID, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were both serious about a wealth tax, and there's a lot of good cases made for it. These unbelievable fortunes have not really been earned. They're a sure sign that there's something wrong in the whole system. But wasn't it strange that under the cloud of COVID, both of those candidates were eliminated, and Joe Biden, who doesn't believe in the wealth tax, was substituted as the presumed nominee. He still hasn't been nominated. But the big money seemed to work its will in the confusion of March, April, and May. Why not a wealth tax?
Well, you know, there's a case to be made on both sides of that, right? So one is finding wealth, right? Which is, it turns out that there may not be as much wealth as some of the proponents of a wealth tax appear to think there is. I think that there are a large number of people in the U.S. who think if someone gets really wealthy because they invent something that makes all of us better off, people are happy for that person.
No, I think we all like that. Invent a better mousetrap and the world will be the path to your door, said the great Ralph Waldo Emerson. And it's right, and it's okay. But inventing a monopoly like Facebook or Apple that not only keeps co-opting and buying up its might-be competitors and basically extracts money, information, saleable information from its customers, that's not a better mousetrap.
No, but you should stop that, not tax it. I mean, one of the lines that we say in the book that we're pleased to see is being widely quoted is, you know, when someone's stealing stuff, you don't want to tax the proceeds of their theft. What you want to do is stop them stealing. So what you're talking about Amazon or Google or Apple and so on, you should stop them doing those things.
Who's going to do it?
Well, the government, eventually people are going to get really upset and there'll be enough political pressure to do something about it. Just as, you know, the police unions, you know, have been untouchable till now. And then all of a sudden, you know, there's Albany, for goodness sake, where you can never get anything passed at all because it's so in the hands of all these vested interests. And they've passed all these laws regulating the police in the last few days. So the lobbyists are powerless against huge amount of public attention. And that's what it's going to take in this. And I hope that after this COVID epidemic, people will start seriously, because there'll be further consolidation in this. And we really want to think about, you know, proper regulation of the tech giants, and not just the tech giants. I mean, there are places like Walmart, too, and firms that are acting as monopolists.
And hospitals, for example.
And hospitals.
What would be your route into controlling them, dismantling them, correcting them, as the police departments are going to be dismantled and corrected?
And the FTC is hard at work at this. In fact, I talked to someone who had been working there, and I said, why isn't the FTC all over hospital mergers? Because when they merge, the prices go up instead of down, which is what you thought should have happened if there were synergies, for example. And the person said, right now at the FTC, everyone is working on the tech problems. And in economics, actually, there's really good work being done right now on what might be done and how it might be done. But that work is still continuing apace. It will take some time before I think there's agreement on what should be done. But I think that the FTC would be our first step for something like that.
Wow. I mean, I must say that's a very old-fashioned, almost Lyndon Johnson, Kennedy era faith in the FTC will fix that problem.
No, it's the FTC propelled by anger, by public anger, and also by skilled economists working there, and also in the Justice Department, who think this has gone too far. So one story is, we come out of this COVID, there's been huge consolidation. The tech companies, which are too powerful already, are now seen as intolerably powerful. And then you could get a coalition that would push that, especially if the Dems take the Senate and they extend their margin in the House. So that, I think that's perfectly plausible. Having a wealth tax which forces Jeff Bezos to sell Amazon, I'm not sure what could that would do.
To me, the $64,000 question in this very uncertain moment is, could the Black Rebellion, which has had incredible influence already on police work and thinking and politics, what's the chance of that melding with a real movement among the downwardly mobile working class, white and Black?
So one of the things that's interesting is that on a lot of metrics, Blacks and whites without a college degree look much more like each other than they look like whites with a college degree and Blacks with a college degree. So we think that if
a problem of class as well as race.
The big difference, of course, is that something only like about 20% of Blacks have a four-year college degree, 22% or something,
yeah.
And more than a third of whites do. So there's a big disadvantage there, just in terms of your chance of going to college if you're African-American. But I think, you know, wouldn't that be wonderful if these two groups that are suffering so much made common cause? But the leader of the people, the white people who suffered so much, is Donald Trump, right? Hmm. And Donald Trump's made a common cause with this African-American uprising? I don't think so. And also, you know, the whole history of America is about using the fact that, you know, we quote Martin Luther King at the beginning of the book about Jim Crow being used by white racists to keep down working class whites as well as Blacks.
But it makes me a little bit more hopeful seeing the protests, which are every race out there saying this has to stop, right? So it's possible, and it may not happen in the entire country at once, but if you look at conservative voices who during the 70s, for example, said, well, it's Black culture. That's why the people aren't getting married. That's why they're having kids out of wedlock and they're not in the labor force. Those exact same voices are saying, well, it's white working class culture. That's why they're not getting married and blah, blah. And we think that, you know, it's not really about the culture. It's really about just the
opportunities.
And
right.
If you treat people shabbily enough, long enough, bad things happen.
And in the end, isn't it all really about money and jobs?
Well, it's not about money or jobs. It's
paying the rent, something on the table.
Yeah, it is the fuel, though, Angus.
Yeah, no, I agree. But, I mean, I don't want to say it's about money, because life is much more important than that. I mean, I think the alliance you're going to get with the Black uprising is between highly educated whites and blacks.
One reads your book, I must say, with great fascination, and it's beautifully written, but thinking, where is the rebellion? I mean, before people take their lives, you'd think we'd hear of a political movement, of a broad-based pain in the society, and somebody would champion it. Where has that been? And could it see, oh my God, Black Lives Matter is roiling the whole country. There's got to be a way to speak out with that kind of clarity.
That's right. It's a really, really good question. We've thought about it a lot. I remember years and years ago, I think the very first book that Paul Krugman wrote, which is called The Age of Diminished Expectations, something of the sort. And he poses the question, you know, and this was written in maybe 1988 or 89. And he says, you know, if in 1950 or even 1960, you told people what would happen to the distribution of income over the next 25 years, the widening of inequality in America, they would have said there would be a revolution. Why has that revolution not taken place? Well, here we are now with another 30, 40 years of growing inequality, and we still haven't had a revolution. So predicting revolutions is really hard.
The other thing is that the epidemic that we're talking about in the book, which is going, unfortunately, to be with us probably after there's a vaccine for COVID or treatments for COVID, that epidemic is more or less invisible, right? It's something that is much harder for people to talk about. Suicide is very hard for people to talk about.
Right.
And it's happening below the radar. So maybe if people become more comfortable talking about it and come to terms with the fact that it's happening, maybe that'll help bring it into public discourse.
I'm thinking of the historian you quote early on in your book who said that inequality, once it is established, is only overcome by violent ruptures, and that this has been true since the Stone Age.
There's a lot of dispute about that book, though. You know, we quote it. You know, there was a lot of the huge inequality of the Gilded Age in the U.S. was overcome without a revolution. I mean, it's true there were world wars in there, but it's not clear that the world wars in America, at least, were what was responsible for the decline in inequality.
And World War II, horrific event, did lead to the post-war bargain, as it was called, and a great narrowing of inequality. That's where our lives began.
That's right. But it wasn't that much lower after World War II than it was before, I think. I mean, the big drop was after World War I, this famous U-shape, where it's sort of flat in the middle of the century. But it's certainly true the Treaty of Detroit and all the rest of it really did make the U.S. much more equal for a long time.
I mean, we were protected by tariffs. We tried to keep global imports out when we entered the global marketplace. No, winners and losers. But the winners never compensate the losers. And maybe we need to find a way to make that happen or pull back on globalization a bit, which is probably going to happen anyway following what's happened with COVID. We don't want to necessarily only have one supplier of X or Y. We may want to be making more of those things locally. So that may also right the ship a bit.
One more crack at the global context. How is it, on so many particulars, the United States record, the suicides, for example, the runaway capitalism, the incredible concentration of wealth and political power, why hasn't it been matched abroad? What's wrong with us? Or is this the final American exceptionalism that our capitalists think they can get away with it forever?
You know, it's one of the reasons that we talk about the healthcare system, because other countries don't have this predatory healthcare system that we do. And that has protected them. But it's not at all clear. I mean, we wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs trying to argue this through as to whether it was just America was going first. And it will be happening elsewhere. There's been a very long stagnation of working class wages in Britain, not nearly as long as here, but still a long period. And many people in Britain are really worried about it. And these drug deaths are beginning to tick up. And there was an episode in Australia. It's not at all clear that it's not going to happen elsewhere in time. Hmm. But they don't have this enormous tax on working class wages that we have.
I have a political question. One of the characteristics of the people who've killed themselves in this epidemic that you write about is that they don't seem to have any hope in politics. It's a big difference, perhaps, with African America. But look at 2020, what has happened so far, specifically in the Democratic primaries. What really plausible ideas were launched about correcting this underlying condition of the country? Not much on real reform of healthcare. Joe Biden is still in Obama land, but also on free tuition, a very big deal. No clear verdict from the Democratic electorate. It seems to me it's not been a good year for politics clarifying what the people want and what the people may need desperately.
Well, I think it will in some respects. The Black Rebellion, if you're going to call it that. You know, the Democrats basically abandoned the unions after the early 70s. And the Democratic Alliance is an alliance between the educated folks on the one hand and minorities on the other. The Republicans, you know, moved in the direction that the Republicans moved in. So the Republicans, the people who are representing, to the extent they're representing at all, people who are suffering from deaths of despair. I don't see the Democrats, you could be very cynical about this. Free tuition for college will basically benefit the middle classes who are sending their kids to college anyway, and they're going to get further tax subsidy at the expense of the rest of us. And healthcare, where the Democrats talk much more about coverage than they talk about cost, will benefit minorities more than it will benefit anyone else. Hmm. And the people that we write about in the book are not represented in this at all. So, well, they're represented by Republicans, but Republicans, as far as this is concerned, are mostly, you know, represent business interests. So we're not very hopeful about the politics of this. Hmm. And I think the Black Rebellion will help the Dems, but I don't think it's going to help the people we're talking about.
If we want to see real change, just to take as an example, the healthcare system, it's something that people in the middle of the distribution have to be talking about, right? We can't rely on...
Explain that.
Well, it can't just be something that people on the left or the far left are talking about. It has to be people saying, this has got to stop. Look, 30 million people lost their jobs and some large fraction of them lost their health insurance as a result of that. This doesn't make any sense to me. Why do we fund our healthcare system through employers? It may be that it's happening to enough people that COVID could break something open, but that still remains to be seen.
Absolutely.
Right? If there is a vaccine, is it affordable, right? If it's not affordable, that could also be another way things might break open.
It could break the economy and break the spell of privilege and runaway capitalism all at the same time.
Maybe. Here's but, something. You know, we don't want to break all of capitalism because it's still got a lot of work to do.
Speak of the future of American capitalism.
I think, you know, one of the issues that I'm not at all in favor of wealth tax, but I am in favor of much better regulation of capitalism. And those rules have been on the books for 100 years, and they just need to be better enforced.
I want to thank you for your book, which seems to me has really become part of our consciousness, that our economy, our situation, very broadly, is killing people in terribly painful, tragic ways. Feels like a kitchen conversation we're having about the wider causes and the wider implications. Angus Deaton, Anne Case, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure, Chris.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun talking to you.
The book from Anne Case and Angus Deaton is titled Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. Please consider supporting Open Source. The best way is with a monthly subscription on Patreon. The first bonus, You can listen to Adam Coleman's series of conversations about storytelling in a time of social distance. This week, one of the titans of alternative comic books, Gilbert Hernandez, who with his brothers created the classic series Love and Rockets. Find that conversation at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our superstar engineer. Mary McGrath keeps us from despairing. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.